Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Condensed Histories, the podcast that takes pop culture and reveals the real history underneath. I'm your host, Jem Deducu, and what we're doing this time round, well, I'm largely wrapping it around one Mr. Stephen King. But what I am talking about in general is horror. And the history of horror is older than you might first think. I'm going to say the first proper horror novel, I'm going to stop doing that by the way, predates something like the Peterloo Massacre. It's early 1800s, an amazing feat, and the first writer of a proper horror novel was a woman. So, it's a good chance to big up a woman in history, women in literature, the genre of horror, and why does it still make box office at the movies, and how Stephen King is still writing books and still selling hundreds of thousands, if not millions of copies of these books. It's a really interesting part of clearly pop culture, but also generally societal culture as well, because I'm going to be talking about one very large market that really doesn't like horror movies. So there's a lot going on here, and I will first of all start with one Mr. Stephen King, who was born in 1947. See, it's got me thinking. I watched a video on YouTube. It was a person who talks a lot about movies and their love of movies, but made the very valid point that when we talk about some of the most impressive filmmakers alive today and their remarkable back catalogues, the likes of Sir Ridley Scott or Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, these sorts of people are now in their 80s. And what this person was saying, not that they were in any way wishing this, it was more a case of sadness that in the next 10 years, we're likely to see most of these people pass into the history books, not making any more films. It is quite remarkable to point out that whereas Sir Ridley Scott is 85, and I did a whole episode on Napoleon that came out in 2023, from Gladiator, which came out in the year 2000, to Napoleon, he's made, including Napoleon, 19 films in the 21st century. So he's really not slowing down. Well done him. And Steven Spielberg's still producing quite a lot. Scorsese slowed down. But the point is, again, with Stephen King, we're talking about a guy who, born in 47, started writing at 20, so that's 1967, before man landed on the moon. His debut novel was Carrie, which came out in 1974. And what's interesting is, just 2 years later, it gets turned into a movie. The famous original movie of Carrie comes out in 1976.
After all you've been taught,
everyone in Bad Mama, everything in the sin.
Come to your closet and pray, ask to be forgiven.
There's been a total of four movies around Carrie. One of them's a sequel as well, a movie sequel. There's been reboots, etc. And, of course, because the world is weird, in 1988, Carrie was also turned into a musical. Because nothing says musical like horror.
Sometimes there are
question mark. But then I guess Phantom of the Opera's a sort of horror and is a very successful musical. I digress a little bit on that. But yeah, the thing is, with Stephen King being born in 47, he's not getting any younger, because that's how time works. And so, regrettably, at some point, he will pass away. And right now, at the time of recording, this man has not wasted any time, because 1974 to 2024 means that, congratulations, Mr. King, you have had a 50-year career of writing books. The movies came a little bit later. That's impressive. But here's the thing. In those 50 years, he has had published 65 novels. So that's averaging more than one a year. And there's been 12 collections of various short stories and various bits of work. One of the most famous movies of all time is The Shawshank Redemption, and that is based on a Stephen King short story. Amazing. He's also written 19 screenplays. So the man just keeps working. Now, admittedly, he had quite the drug stimulant problem back in the 80s. That might have helped him bash out a few of those books, but he's still writing now, and he is clean now, for the record. And some of his books, something like, for example, Stephen King's It, that gets made into a TV miniseries in 1990, but then it gets remade in the 21st century into a two-part movie, and that grosses hundreds of millions of dollars. There's still a huge appetite for his stuff. So, 74, first book, 75, second book. Already, he's not wasting any time. Second book, for the record, is a vampire story. It's Salem's Lot. So if you think about it from his perspective, in 1974, he writes his first book. In 1975, he writes his second book. Then in 1976, he gets the movie of his first book. In 1977, he comes out with two books, one of them being The Shining. And then 1979, Salem's Lot's turned into a two-part TV series. And then in 1980, The Shining comes out, directed by Stanley Kubrick, the man behind Clockwork Orange and Spartacus and so many 2001 A Space Odyssey, so many other classic movies. However, it is well under record that Stephen King hated it because he wanted to focus more on the father and his abusive relationship with his son. And the whole story is, apparently, according to Stephen King, a metaphor for alcoholism, something else that he struggled with over his life. And the whole point is, spoiler for the book that's nearly 50 years old, it all hangs round, there's obviously supernatural going on, but the critical bit at the end is it's to do with the boiler, and the boiler explodes, and that's what kills the father. It's that self-destructive, explosive anger linked to the alcoholism that ties it all up. So, to therefore have Jack Nicholson, spoiler for a film that's nearly 45 years old, the end of The Shining, it's completely different.
Here's Johnny!
He chases Danny round this snowy maze, and in the end, he freezes to death, and then you've got the famous reveal at the end. But the point is that you've got a completely different reading of it. Now, most people think that The Shining is a horror masterpiece. I would agree. But Stephen King didn't, and he remade it. He wrote the screenplay, directed it, one of the few times he's ever directed, and yeah, it's very accurate to the book. Well done, Stephen. Nobody liked the movie. And also, going toe-to-toe with Stanley Kubrick, it better be good. And it isn't. All right, let's just move on. But yeah, this guy has produced 65 novels. And what's been obvious since the 1930s is you've got novels being turned into books. I've said this many times before, but the biggest grossing movie of all time, if you adapt for inflation, is Gone with the Wind, which is, of course, based on a book. But the rules of books is pretty simple. It was the same in the 1930s with Gone with the Wind as it is today, as it was with Stephen King back in the 70s, which is when the book hits big, everybody's talking about it. So you need to sell those book rights into movie rights as quickly as possible and get that movie out as fast as you can. Now, there are exceptions to this, Lord of the Rings, for example. However, the point here is that we've got this whole genre that is ripe for being turned into movies. And what do people like about books, and indeed comic books, is both of them have done the story for you. Basing it on an existing IP, well, if it's an international bestseller, people are probably going to want to see the movie version. And generally, the movie version isn't as good as the book. But what do the writers always say? I think what they really want to say is, hey, I got paid a lot of money for this. I earn a lot more money out of film rights than I do out of book sales. And that's true. If you look at any of them, you know, Stephen King or even J.K. Rowling, they have earned the vast majority of their money through the non-book elements of their IP. That's just how business works. But what they always say instead is, well, this is the film interpretation. It's a different medium of art, and therefore it does have to change, which is absolutely true. But clearly some people put a lot more love into it, and sometimes it's just a quick cash grab. And yeah, some of Stephen King's stuff is not good film-wise. However, when you look at the history of horror, I've talked in the past. I did one about Final Fantasy 16 and The Witcher, and I started talking about Slavic ghost stories and folk tales and things like that. That, you could argue, is the start of horror. The idea of people sitting around, not necessarily a campfire, but like a hearth in a family home. People are illiterate. Telling stories is so important in the pre-industrial world. Brief aside, a family aside here, and I do feel obliged to say that my Turkish grandfather was absolutely literate, but this is really interesting. My mother from America went to Turkey for the first time, and we're talking about Turkey in the late 1960s. It might as well have been Birmingham in 1900. And what she found interesting was my grandfather, her soon-to-be father-in-law, was just a great storyteller. People would get excited about how he was going to sit down and tell a story. And he would take his time, because this is what people did in the past, be it the bards or the traveling storytellers who move from one area to another, the little traveling bands of actors, etc. Nobody wanted it to all be over. This idea of us having YouTube shorts, or if you look at something like an episode of Friends on Netflix with no advertising breaks, where you start realizing that when you strip out all the commercials, this half-hour TV episode is 22 and a half minutes. They pack a lot in those 22 and a half minutes. But then you get the likes of Beowulf, for example, which has a structure of a horror movie. The idea of Beowulf, and that goes off on lots of different tangents, is the idea that Beowulf has to fight this monster, Grendel. And then just when he thinks, oh, that's sorted, well, Grendel has a much more powerful, much more malevolent mother. So that's the kind of thing you get in a standard horror movie in the 21st century. But that is from the 6th century AD. And going back to my Turkish grandfather, he didn't tell horror stories or scary stories, but you just take your time with these things, and everybody was enraptured. And it was the language that was used that would pull people in. The intonation, as the storyteller goes on, in essence, they're using their voice to add the special effects. They're in a dark forest, and they can hear things snapping and cracking around them. And just by lowering your voice, people move in. They want to hear what's saying. They don't want to miss a moment. And clearly, where a lot of these folktales come from, and spoiler alert, there is no evidence of witches or ghosts or goblins or elves or whatever, okay? But how do you explain these strange noises, sometimes these strange hallucinations that happen in forests, etc.? So you get this idea of malevolent spirits. And one of the things a lot of horror writers say, and indeed historians, is in the modern world, it's very hard for us to understand how dark night was. I know that sounds weird, but you've got street lights, you've got a phone, you're no more than a few meters away from a light switch. And so genuine, total darkness is something that would happen. on a winter's night when the sky is covered by thick cloud cover. And in Northern Europe, that's a pretty spooky time. And if you are caught out and about when you've only got a flickering torch in your hand, and there were things like wolf packs, wild boar, things that if you startle could actually hurt you, bears in some parts of Europe. These things were potentially dangerous. They've just been annihilated over the years through hunting. So this has always fascinated me. Things that go bump in the night is something that fundamentally works even to this day. I mentioned a while ago, I can't remember, 4 months ago, something like that, I did the War of the Worlds episode, and I mentioned that I went to the live experience. Well, in one part in the live experience, you're in a completely dark room. You're sitting down, they made sure that you're safe. They've set it up, but just having it completely dark and hearing these noises, and people saying, the actors like, what's that? Is that something against the window? Very cheap, costs nothing. But your mind is ablaze with danger. So, these stories about malevolent spirits, ghosts, people rising from the dead to want vengeance, this is something that goes across many civilizations. And even though these are oral traditions, some of them have been remembered in fairy tales or folklore, etc. And I'm not going to call those horror stories, but here's the thing. Why do people want to hear them? Why do I want to hear about dangerous stuff? Because that's fundamentally how a story works. There has to be a problem, and then there has to be a solution later on. And quite often, these folkloric tales have some kind of moral story in them as well, a parable, if you will. And I do like that. Stephen King has said that horror is actually, it gets a lot of flack from censors, and particularly he was talking about this in the 1980s, and there was the concept of the video nasty. More on that in a moment. But what he was saying is that it gets a lot of stick, but actually it's a very conservative and traditional art form, because the whole point of a horror story is there is this horrible, evil thing, malevolent, and what's everybody trying to do in the story? Kill it. Overwhelm it, take it away from harm's way. Everybody wants to get rid of it. Freddy Krueger in the Nightmare Upon Elm Street movies, he was weirdly turned into a bit of a anti-hero of the movie. You know, how's he going to kill the next teen? That's a bit weird. Things did get weird in the 1980s, but if you look at the original Nightmare on Elm Street, that one, he's just out and out the villain, and it's all about trying to kill him. Fun fact, that's one of the first movie Johnny Depp is in. He's very young Johnny Depp, and he dies. And boy, does Johnny Depp have an insane amount of blood in his body. It's just, yeah, great scene though. Very great scene. As Stephen King says, we're just trying to get back to normal. We're trying to get rid of the monster that's under your bed. And the monster under your bed is something that I think all young children experience. And this idea, adorable idea, if you tightly tuck yourself under the covers, you're safe. Now, of course, if there's an actual tiger trying to kill you, that's not going to provide any kind of protection. But to little children's vivid imaginations, it's enough. That is the origin of the horror story. Let's talk about the first modern horror novel, which is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is also an early science-gone-wrong type story as well. So you've got DNA from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein going all the way into the likes of Terminator or any movie today or story today about AI gone wrong. We've created this thing. How do we deal with it? Incredibly prescient story, which is loosely based on, not actual reanimation, but at the time of writing, there was all these experiments to do with electricity, and this was the time when people would carry out surgery and autopsies and scientific experiments in front of an audience, which I would like to see a return to, thank you very much. Something like the Science Museum does actually have these sorts of things, not with dead bodies, but for children doing various things to do with elements, to explain things, and why is this working this way, etc. Great fun with the kids, but why not do it with adults as well? Why must we watch Love Island rather than seeing a really interesting lecture which of somebody who really knows what they're talking about as they walk you through the use of hydrogen, or acids, or maybe an autopsy. That might be a bit too much for people. So that's what was happening at the time that Mary Shelley was writing. And there was an observation that if you pass an electric current through things like frogs' legs, they would spasm, they would twitch. It's almost like they'd come to life, even though the frog is very much dead. How could this be? And so she extrapolates with it. It's science fiction. There are some people who say it's the first science fiction novel as well, in which case, if it is, the tone is horror. It's more Alien than Star Wars, which I find fascinating. And to this day, in my experience, there are more women, particularly young women, who are more into horror than young men. Why? I don't know. And if we're going to go back to Carrie, the first Stephen King novel, it's of course about a...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Young woman who gets these psychic powers, and this coincides with her menstrual cycle starting, and the famous scene both in the book and in the movie at the prom, when after she'd been teased about some of her menstrual blood being seen by some of the other kids in the school, boy, does she get her revenge in the end of that movie. And I said the famous end of The Shining, but one of the most famous jump scares ever in cinema history is at the end of the original Carrie. And it's so cleanly done. Do you want to know how they did it? Because this is all before CGI and things like that. How do they do it? The whole thing is done in reverse. So I won't say what it is, because you might want to see it, but I'm going to just put my cards on the table. I'm not a huge fan of horror. It wasn't Stephen King, but somebody else said that fear without danger equals fun. And I get that. That's the point of a roller coaster as well. If you were that out of control, or apparently that out of control, in a car traveling at those speeds, hitting those G-forces, that's probably the last thing you're ever going to remember before you're in a casket. But here, in a highly safe environment of a roller coaster, you can experience G-forces, twists and turns, and they're hugely popular going on those thrill rides. Again, not a huge fan of those. In the case of horror movies, I've got such a vivid imagination, this stuff just lingers in my head for a long time. And what I would say about, Stephen King's probably going to disagree with me with this, but when it comes to Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, the thing about that is, it doesn't really have much in the way of jump scares. It's got a few, but what it's really about is creating this amazing sense of dread. And there are a few movies where it's almost thick with foreboding. And that kind of stuff, I think, is much harder to do than just having a jump scare. Those are quite often seen by horror aficionados as cheap. It's much harder to do other parts of horror genre in its own way. And I'm going to go back to Mary Shelley. What she does there is she talks about the classic thing of mankind, just because you can do it, does that mean you should do it? And also mankind's fear of the unknown. And the monster initially is not a threat, but it's the reaction to the monster that turns it into a threat. It's an incredibly mature piece of work, but I still haven't told you when she wrote it. It was published in 1818. Now, I did mention Peterloo. If you don't know, that was when there was a large group of working class people who were protesting in a civil manner, where the government sent the cavalry into them, literally the army into them, and some of those units had seen battle at Waterloo, which is why it gets known as the Peterloo Massacre, and that was in 1819. It is not beyond the realms of possibility that somebody in that crowd might have been carrying Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in their knapsack or something like that. Again, just to put this into context, yes, Napoleon was defeated in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo, but he died in 1821. So theoretically, you could get somebody like Napoleon reading Frankenstein. There is no record of that, for the record. I'm not saying that that was definitely a thing, but it just, this gives you an idea of how old that book is, was, etc. And people still read it, and it's still inspiring things to this day. And it does get remade. So I'm not saying that Stephen King invented horror, but he's one of the most successful horror writers. The other one, I've done a whole episode on vampires, is at the end of the 19th century, we get Bram Stoker's Dracula. And the idea of the vampire is something that Stephen King has meditated on. His second book, Salem's Lot, is indeed about vampires. But he said, and I'm going to change this to keep my clean rating, he basically makes this comment in, as I said, he's done all these collections. He's even written a few books on writing or on horror. And I'm going to say this is a man who knows what he's talking about. He's actually turned around and said, what is the appeal of a vampire? Nobody finds leeches attractive or sexy. And yet this is an undead corpse-like leech that is sucking the blood out of you. There is nothing attractive or seductive about it. So why are they kind of seen as sexy? It's a really interesting point. His opinion is, and this is a slight deliberate misquote, he calls it a... how am I going to say this? He calls this lovemaking without the hassle. He refers to it as a zipperless something else. And that's the thing. This idea, I've been having this conversation with a couple of people recently about what is romance? Because after all, kissing itself, reading and they kissed, isn't in any way satisfying. Why do we kiss? Because it feels nice, but just reading the words, problematic. It's also a huge problem when it comes to love scenes in a novel or something like that, because why is it nice? It's how it feels, but you then have to describe it. So do you describe it accurately using medical terms, which takes all of the romance out of it, or do you start using euphemisms, in which case it can get ridiculous very quickly? So I'm not going there. For the record, in a couple of my novels, I did end up having love scenes. I thought that they were important for the characters and also to say that, look, these are adults in an adult relationship. And that was the hardest thing to write, full stop. I could write about war crimes, which were draining to do, but that was something where you could stick to just the factually accurate statements. You know, I've used my imagination in many different areas, but that's super hard. And I just always remember that scene in, I think it's the first series of Friends, when Rachel is inspired by Chandler's mother, who writes erotic fiction. Then right at the end of the episode, she goes, all right, I'm handing this stuff out for you to all read, and I'm hoping that Greg can find it. It will keep us still clean rating, and it's just hilarious, and it just shows the problems of writing about that kind of stuff.
Okay. Now, this is just the first chapter. and I want your absolute, honest opinion, okay? Oh, and on page 2, he's not reaching for her heaving beasts.
Wait, what's a niffle?
You can usually find them on the heaving beasts.
All right, so I'm not a great typist.
Wait, did you get to the part about his huge throbbing pens? Tell ya, you don't want to be around when he starts writing with those.
So, moving on, the idea of, you know, why is kissing romantic, all these sorts of things, because it's the seduction side of it. It's like the mind games. Are they going to let you in? Are they going to go in the direction you want them to do? Which is very exciting. This is something that is, you know, fun in a relationship. I'm in a relationship. You get that little sort of twinkle in your eye. That's lovely. And a, you know, way to describe that. And so it's the same thing with a vampire. Can they trick the person? Not obviously to make love, but instead it's like, you know, to let me bite you and take something from you. And that's the appeal there. However, you do get other versions, something like Nosferatu, for example. So there were many different versions of Bram Stoker's Dracula throughout the whole of Hollywood. I've mentioned Lord of the Rings. The amazing thing about Sir Christopher Lee is this man was the definitive Dracula. He was a bad guy in a James Bond movie. He's a key bad guy in the Star Wars movies. He's a key bad guy in the Lord of the Rings movies. And that isn't including the more than 100 plus other films that he's done. The man's a legend. But you get Nosferatu, a silent movie, which I have actually seen all of, in a movie theatre as well. It was really quite impressive. There was a talk about it beforehand. But they do away with that dark head, slick back in the sort of dinner jacket type thing with the cape. Instead, he's spindly. He is far more leech-like. There is nothing seductive about him. He is there to tear your blood and soul out from you. And bravo to that. And indeed, with Stephen King, Salem's Lot is far more like that than it is sexy vampire time. And then you get the ridiculous nature of the Twilight movies where they twinkle and one of them's driving a Volvo. That is neither leech-like and terrifying, nor is it sexy either. Just, I'm not a fan of the Twilight movies. So, talked about Mary Shelley, talked about the evolution, and some of the earlier movies and proper narrative movies are horror movies. Once we get into the 1930s, we get the Universal monster movies, where you get the likes of the Dracula film, you get Frankenstein, you get the Wolfman, you get the Mummy, and then you get mashups with all of them together, fighting, etc. And then Abbott and Costello meet Dracula, and you know, you're now turned into comedy. So they make loads of box office. These were huge popular hits. But what's interesting is today, in the 21st century, horror is still a really big deal. You get something as ridiculous as Five Nights at Freddy's, which were cheap indie video games that made a ton of money, and they're all about jump scares. And in 2023, it's turned into a movie. And it's got a very tight budget of $20 million, and it grosses about $250 million worldwide. It's a huge hit. It gets pretty poor reviews, and this is the thing about a lot of horror movies. They tend to be seen as not worthy. Now, there are some people, Mark Kermode, for example, he's a very respected movie critic in Britain. He's a huge fan of horror movies, so he'll wax lyrical about The Exorcist or about, I don't know, Suspira, and there are so many other ones that he really likes. Obviously, he likes The Shining too. But when he critiques a horror movie, he's doing it from the point of view of a fan, and he'll turn around and say, yeah, yeah, this was a good one. The Babadook is a great modern horror masterpiece, or Hereditary, and so on and so forth. And this is the thing, they're still making good horror movies. The first Stephen King's It in two parts. The first one, everybody agrees, the clown is creepy as hell, and it's really quite a scary movie. The problem was the second half wasn't as good, but the first half, genuinely scary movie, made a load of money. Also, it got good reviews. Everybody's happy in that situation. Bravo to Stephen King's It. And And it's the thing with Stephen King, he's not a one-trick pony. Whatever your favourite is, there's the Dark Tower movies. That's a whole thing which starts making reference to some of his other movies. So I keep saying movies. These things have been turned into movies, but also, obviously, books as well. You got Doctor Sleep, which is where Danny from The Shining has grown up, and he's still using his psychic abilities as a psychiatrist, and he helps people with insomnia. And so he gets his own kind of weird spin-offs of some of his ideas. There is always something else coming out from his imagination. It could be Christine, it could be Cujo. The list is a lot. He's not just It, but I would say It and The Shining are probably his two most famous works, and yet there are 65 to choose from, plus the short stories. Like I said, look at Shawshank Redemption, which is a completely different type of movie. You also get The Green Mile. You also get The Apt Pupil, which is an amazing movie directed by, sadly, Bryan Singer. And this was kind of the first signs of problems with Bryan Singer, because the young teenager in it said that bad things happened on set, which everybody kind of ignored at the time. Very, very bad. But it's a very good story and a very good book, and an early sign that you get Sir Ian McKellen. He's sort of, at that time, not really that well known. Just a brief sidebar, Hollywood, up until At Pupil, probably best knew, this is going to sound weird, Sir Ian McKellen gets to play Death in The Last Action Hero. If you don't know that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Last Action Hero is a very high concept film, which actually is aged pretty well. It's got some interesting things to say, but it is a flawed film. It's certainly not Arnie's best, but a kid gets sucked into an action film which Arnold Schwarzenegger's playing a character called Jack Slater, and the movie's all about a magic ticket, and so they keep jumping from the real world, which is horrible, and the movie world, which is that heightened reality that we all pay to see, and it makes the point that movies aren't real, but the ticket kind of goes wild, and at one point it floats into the seventh seal. Yes, that art house Swedish movie is snuck into a big action film. So's Hamlet, by the way. And famously, you have the lead character playing chess with Death. Now, that's a real thing in the movie, and Death comes out of the movie, and it's played by Sir Ian McKellen, which I obviously at the time I didn't know, but watching it again, it's like, oh my God, they got Gandalf or Magneto playing Death.
I was only curious. He's not on any of my lists. Though you are, Daniel.
Now?
Oh, no. You'd die a grandfather.
Obviously, Sir Ian McKellen's done so many more things than that, but you get my point on that. I've kind of gone off on a random tangent there. So, you have all of this being pulled together in the world and genre of horror. I'm going to be a bit more fun about horror moving forwards. And just before I do this sort of last bit, which is a bit more fun, as always, please click subscribe. Hey, tell another human being about this. If you enjoy this podcast, feel free to share the stuff on whatever you use on social media, your Instagrams, your Facebooks, your Twitters, X's, whatever, Threads, yada, yada, yada. But why not actually tell somebody? Maybe it's a family friend. Well, maybe it's a member of family, maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a work colleague going, hey, you like that kind of stuff. I'm really enjoying this. Hey, why don't you listen to Condensed Histories? Please help spread the word and give us a review as well. Only takes a few seconds. Thank you very much. So as I said earlier, fear without the danger equals fun. I will never forget the first time I saw a horror movie. I generally, like I said, do not go to the cinema to see horror films. But I went with my then girlfriend to see the original Candyman, and I found it terrifying. As people have said subsequently, I didn't know this at the time, if you find a movie scary, don't cover your eyes, cover your ears. The scares are really in terms of the music and the jolts and the noises. And as I've said in a previous episode, there are some horror movies that actually have two soundtracks. The one that you can hear with the strings making noises. And then there's one that's actually under the human hearing range. So there's a part of your body that knows that you're missing something, but you don't know what it is, which creates this sense of ill ease, which is a genius bit of sound design or technical design for a horror film. I believe the first Paranormal Activity uses that technique. Well done. Some people might call it cheating, but I say no, you use everything you can to create the image and atmosphere that you're looking for. You go for it. But a lot of these movies, these horror movies, are pretty low budget. So even if they don't make a lot at the box office, they probably made enough to cover their production costs. And they also tend to evaporate pretty quickly from the movie theaters. But then they always get a bit of a reimagining, a renaissance when it comes to Halloween as well. Release them around Halloween, re-release them on like home viewing, etc. But going back to that movie, Candyman, I was there. I was finding it very scary. But the first time there was a jump scare, it's like, why would people go on a date to see somebody be decapitated? That makes no sense. That's not a cool thing. It's not going to get anybody in the mood. First jump scare, she grabs me out of fear. And you could have seen that light bulb illuminate the whole of the theatre. It was a glorious moment, I'm not going to say. So which market isn't particularly hot for horror? Well, it's interesting. It turns out to be China, which is a major market for movies. It turns out that their ancestor worship, the idea that they don't want to disturb the dead as a sign of respect, which I absolutely get, means that any kind of ghost story, even if it's Casper the Friendly Ghost, is seen as disrespectful. Now, add to it blood-sucking horrors from beyond the grave, and that's why horror movies basically don't get released in China. What's also interesting is, like so many different genres, there are different levels of it. There is psychological horror, there's very low-budget horror, there's very grand horror. Bram Stoker's Dracula was turned into, by Francis Ford Coppola, an amazingly expensive, extravagant, set-laden movie, which in many ways is just a masterpiece. It's so out there and outrageous, except for the fact that Keanu Reeves cannot do an English accent to save his life, and he has limited acting appeal, and this is way out of his wheelhouse. But there are like kids horror movies, which obviously have no blood in them, but there are really fun, spooky movies. Monster House, for example, which really did freak out my boys when they were little. And there are sort of scary moments in other films as well. Raiders of the Lost Ark, there are genuinely scary moments, like with all the mummies when they're in the tomb in Egypt. So there are elements of horror that are kid-friendly, adult-friendly, big budget, low budget, huge hits, real disappointments, literary. I love it. It's a really interesting and diverse topic to talk about, and it's not going to go away, because fundamentally that adrenaline hit when you get that jolt from a jump scare is something that will keep people coming back to the movies. That's it from me, and as always, another episode coming soon.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.